Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric. I'm here with Michael. And the theme today is two men and a baby. What is... No, that doesn't make sense.
The theme today is, I guess, the individual paranoia of decades given film.
Yeah, that kind of made sense, despite I think you spoke the sentence backwards. You were possessed by demons,
yeah,
is what happened.
Pod people.
These are two films that came at the end of their decades, 68 and 78, and were really representative of what happened in the decade and what was kind of freaking people out, especially Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Yeah. Rosemary's Baby, I think. So those are the two films, by the way. It's Rosemary's Baby and Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I feel like Rosemary's Baby kind of almost anticipated what people were going to be afraid of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it got lucky, and we'll talk about that. But Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I think, was very representative of... It was almost late to the game as far as what are people scared of? Let's give that to them. Also, two different genres.
Yeah.
I don't know that we do that often, do we?
Not too often.
Not really sure that both of these movies go together. I think we kind of have that problem again.
Yeah.
Maybe not a great double feature to watch back to back, but one that makes a lot of sense for talking about sci-fi pulling from fears of the decade. And Invasion of the Body Snatchers does feel a bit like horror,
yeah,
and science fiction. Just because it had remakes that were a little bit more science fiction-y. And an original that I assume, I wasn't around in the 50s,
mm-hmm,
so I don't know if people were actually afraid of that, but sci-fi oftentimes has some fear stuff pulled into it. And then Rosemary's Baby, which just scares the crap out of you. So we're going to spoil both of the films, if we haven't somehow done so already.
You'll tell me that Rosemary's Baby has 0% spoilability, but that's just because you don't accept the ending. And I would say that spoilability for Invasion of the Body Snatchers is pretty high.
Rosemary's Baby is an interesting one because you can almost go back and view the film under sort of different lenses. We'll talk about that. You have different perspectives. But I don't think that would stop it from being spoiled. And Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I would say a screenshot could spoil that, mm-hmm, film. So don't Google that movie before you watch it. If you're afraid of spoilers or bored by Rosemary's Baby, because it is a 3-hour long film, you can fast forward using chapters. Just click the chapter menu thing, iTunes, QuickTime, joke about Zunes, and then you won't get spoiled. Rosemary's Baby is part of the director, Roman Polanski's apartment trilogy. I'm wondering, have you seen any of the other apartment trilogy stuff?
No, I don't think I have.
It's Repulsion, if I remember correctly, and The Tenant are the other ones. It's a pretty broad theme, and the movies do feel very, they feel the same because they're all in apartments. But they hit on very, very different themes in each movie. The overall theme that kind of connects them all is terror in your home. Things to be afraid of, even if you're inside. And especially with a lot of the horror coming out before that, we talked just in the intro about science fiction. It was things coming to the world, nightmarish things that you should be afraid of. And the kind of theme that I really like about the apartment trilogy was that you can't get away from the terror. It's inside your home.
Or inside you, in this case.
Yeah. Yeah, this is about as internal as the terror is going to get. I really like that. So when Roman Polanski did this film, he did not know, he'd never adapted. This was originally a book, Rosemary's Baby, and he never adapted something like this. So he didn't know that you could make changes, which is why this is such a faithful adaptation to the book. Sort of a happy accident, but mm-hmm, I really like that sort of ignorance can make your film, a more faithful adaptation. So we need to, because this is a show that just clears things up all the time, and in providing a public service, have you ever heard this rumor about Anton LaVey?
No, I have not.
All right, so Anton LaVey, crash course for people who don't give a shit, because if you gave a shit, you would already know. There's a thing called the Church of Satan,
okay,
which is what people in high school believe in so that other people will think they're Satanists, and then they can have that really cool conversation they love where they go, "It's just called Satanism. We don't actually worship the devil," that thing?
Right.
Which, by the way, previously on the show, I asked if anyone knew of any people who actually worship the devil to email us, because I don't believe Satanism in an organized form exists. No emails. Still no emails.
All right, so it must not exist. That's
keep them coming,
right there,
people. There is a rumor that Anton LaVey, the head of the Church of Satan, which is not to be confused with actual Satan, but rather ego worship and weird Mother Earth stuff, that he plays the devil or the demon in this film. And I've heard this rumor so many times. It seems almost every time I talk to somebody, especially casual viewers of Rosemary's Baby, about this, the one thing they always have to bring to the conversation is, hey, you know that demon? That's played by Anton LaVey. And that's totally not true. So fuck you guys. So the expertise you're bringing to the show is about babies, because we have so many of those. Yeah, we really don't know anything about babies, but we do a little bit because we've done some baby homework on the show previously.
Yeah, well, that's all we've ever really, that's the only experience I've ever had with a baby in my life, is this film called Inside that we did.
Thankfully.
So we did a film earlier this year called Inside. It's a French film that we paired up with Drag Me to Hell.
Yeah.
And it's almost similar to Rosemary's Baby. Sure. It's a lot about isolation. It's a lot about being stuck in your home.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this whole dynamic where the main character is pregnant, and that kind of becomes the premise for the film.
Sure.
The difference being that the danger is not even, it's not the baby.
Yeah.
It's not what's inside of her. It's the fact that there is another person trying to take it out of her.
It's that simple. It's an external force.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at a lot of the things that are supposed to create the fear in a movie like Inside, which we won't talk about too much because if you listen to the show, you did. And if you've never heard of Inside, you don't care. But Inside is a fear of someone taking your baby. And it's a fear of single mothership, really. Mm-hmm. Having your baby grow up with a single parent, your inability to take care of a baby if you're alone. And I think that's a theme that's a lot more apt for, you know, today's generation, although single parents have existed since the beginning of time. What was a bigger concern at the time of Rosemary's Baby was this fear of actual childbirth. You know, in Inside, there's almost never a fear that the child's not going to make it. That's not what you're afraid of. In fact, the very plot of the film depends on the child making it.
Right.
Whether that has anything to do with what happens in the film or not, that's sort of the running premise. That's what the DVD jacket would tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout Rosemary's Baby, we see all of these nutty concerns that she has about her child being okay.
Right.
You know, right from the beginning, she's talking about, how long does she have a pain? 6 months or something, right?
6 months, yeah.
Yeah, some ridiculous amount of time. Her first two trimesters, she has a pain. And she's worried about what shakes she should drink. And there's just a constant concern that the baby will be born, that everything will be okay. And that's as much a fear that I think every mother has as a fear that mothers with demons growing inside themselves have. So I guess you could essentially boil it down to a fear of miscarriage. Really,
yeah.
Which when we go back to the 60s, a lot of people will tell you that Rosemary's Baby is a movie that sort of capitalized on the baby boomers generation. So after World War II in the United States, anyways, and I'm sure this is probably true for other countries.
Yeah.
All the soldiers came home, had sex with their wives, and there were a lot of babies born from that gender. That seems pretty universal, but I don't know actually if that phenomena exists outside the United States.
The difference between United States in World War II and many of the other countries in World War II is that most of the soldiers in the other countries weren't gone. They were just fighting in
their country.
Yeah, I
guess that's true too. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and our soldiers over there, in fact, may have caused a lot of childbirths in other countries. It's that strong American sperm is really what
that's
it.
Our boys right there, trying out the local foliage.
So the height of, and this is why I say, you know, a lot of people say this, and I'm unsure about if this is really capitalizing. Here's the dates. Think about the dates. So the baby boom happened. The real increase in pregnancies happened starting in the 40s. I'd say around 1946, you really saw that there was a trend going on. And it continued and saw a little bit of a peak again in the 60s. So let's say the baby boom started around 46. That would make people, 22 when Rosemary's Baby came out?
Yeah, 22-ish.
So I guess that makes sense. People have babies when they're 22.
Well,
so people
especially in that generation.
Yeah,
that generation is definitely a generation of young parents.
Yeah, that 18 to 25, that was probably the right time to get married and spit out a kid. So it
you
is.
You don't spit them out.
I don't actually know how babies are born, but I think that's for another podcast. So do you think it's okay to say that this capitalizes on a fear that, you know, the baby boom is a big deal because that means that the most people in the country ever having babies was happening probably around when Rosemary's Baby came out. Actually, it was happening when the baby boom happened, mm-hmm. but all of those people were now growing up, being parents for what's important here, the first time. They weren't in their late 30s pushing out a second kid, because then they would kind of already know what childbirth
is. Sure.
I mean, having a child, it's something that grows inside you for 9 months. Right. It's fucking terrifying.
Yeah, and also earlier on in the well, I guess not so much the 60s. It was more in the late 50s, but there's also just the fear of stuff like Satanism.
Yeah,
not necessarily Satanism as a fear, but just this fear of dark occult groups.
Right, right.
I mean, this did go on in the 60s because this was kind of the beginning and end of different eras of hippieism.
Sure, right.
Which was feared by the general public as, you know, cults, as weird groups. You have
before it became mainstream in the 70s, really.
Right,
it was
exactly.
Sort of an unknown thing. And people would look at that from outside and wonder, what is that devil worship? Because pinning it on devil worship is the easiest thing
to do.
So 68 is probably the perfect year, and maybe even a little bit after that, but you have, you know, the book coming out and the film coming out the very year after. So I think there's something to capitalizing, whether it was intentional or accidental, capitalizing on this fear of first-time parenting. It not only makes the audience a little more frightened, but I think it makes the character a lot more viable.
Sure.
I mean, I guess I would still understand a situation like Rosemary's Baby today. I think that movie could still come out and would still be relevant. But I think especially at the time, here you're seeing characters who probably mid-20s, right?
Yeah.
Characters who are going through it the first time and are just as frightened as the audience is. They can identify with that. And I think that makes them understand, you know, weird Tannis root stuff, all of these milkshakes. She doesn't know who to trust. Because you have to buy that even once she gets this fear, even once she has this fear of demons, she doesn't see another doctor right away.
Well, the best dynamic of the film is the character of Rosemary.
Yeah.
There's no mistake that the name of the film is Rosemary's Baby.
Well, we follow her the whole time.
Mia Farrow plays this character who is, I mean, the character herself of Rosemary is this really innocent human being, probably more so than, you know, any given person I can think of.
Yeah, sure.
She's this overtly innocent person, very trusting. I mean, for at least 80% of the film, she's talking to Guy, her husband,
right,
telling him all this stuff that the audience may, in a dramatic, ironic twist, know. He's not even on her side anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
But she's still basically feeding him all the information that somebody else would have to try to squeeze out of her.
Sure, and you certainly have that fear.
And that's just this weird symbolic thing where it's this, basically it's a portrait of innocence that's been injected with evil.
Mm-hmm.
And it's literally coming from the inside out. And she's just this thin layer protecting what is essentially questionable evil from what's surrounding her, which is just, you know, clans of darkness.
Her own husband, her fucking doctor, the people who live next door, who, by the way, it's bad enough to live next to an elderly couple, as they point out, because they will not leave you alone. But when they're also Satanists, I mean, it's an even bigger problem.
Rough.
Well, and so I think we have a lot to talk about with the ending. But really quick, because I'm Eric Ingram and this is Double Feature, two shots of note, and I will make them very brief.
Do it.
But this movie has some of my favorite cinematography of the late 60s, let's say. The first one is, there is a shot, and it's very brief, but the movie uses this in a lot of subtle ways throughout the film, where she's standing in her room on the telephone. And she is right behind, you might know the scene I'm talking about, but now that I've said this, you'll go back through and I'm sure you'll know it when you see it. She's standing just out of view on the telephone when she takes a call and the camera's out in the hallway. The film makes use of this a couple times, but probably never as well as in that shot. And I've been told by friends of mine who actually saw it in the theater way back that the audience would all crane their head. You're doing it right now. Yeah. To try and see if they could see around the door. Something that, if I'm to believe the friends of mine telling me about this, that the cinematographer did intentionally and didn't explain to Roman Polanski until they were actually watching their film with an audience. He just said, trust me on this, wait till you see your audience reaction. And it gives you this uncomfortable feeling that you get throughout the Apartment trilogy, but never as good as here, that you can't see around every corner. It's a small space. It's claustrophobic.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to know, well, what's happening around that corner, but you're in a stationary position. Because fuck 3D, and you can't move your head to the side. The other one, and I know this is a shot you like too, is when they first move into the apartment, and they're eating dinner on the floor. Yeah, they don't have any furniture yet.
Right.
I think it's really great composition, but I like it because it's something everyone has to do at some point, assuming you move ever in your life. And you don't do it that often, unless you're me and you move every 4.5 months. But most people move into an empty apartment, you know, once a year at least in their adolescence, probably in their 20s, like this couple.
Right.
Until you get married and then you stay somewhere for a while. So it's a really identifiable scene, but just sort of an oddity, something you don't do very often. And then they turn out the lights and the moonlight comes in. They're eating on the floor. Just everything about the scene I really like, including the point where, you know, they have that great exchange. Hey, want to make love? And then they awkwardly undress.
Yeah.
And the scene goes on and you just kind of linger there almost a moment longer than is there's sort of the moment they say that, a little uncomfortability. And then it almost becomes funny for a second while they're taking their clothes off and they transition to the next scene. Just two scenes I really like out of the film. But we should talk about the ending.
Let's talk about the ending. So it should be noted before we go right into the ending that there is, and I'm not, I mean, I'm picking on you. I picked on you earlier, but you're not the only one who has contest with how this film allegedly ends.
Well, it sucks because we did The Prestige. Right. That's the problem here. We did The Prestige with Wizard of Gore, and just to amuse really ourselves, we talked about, you know, a theory that is very much not what the film intended, not what the novel intended, not what the original screenplay intended. But something that, kind of a fan theory, and fan theories amuse me. But if I could try and regain some of my credibility here, I blame this on facets. We talk about facets once in a while, but I attended a film school a film school night at Facets where they talked about Rosemary's Baby. And I've talked to other people about it since, and this was something that Polanski intended. You can go through this film without believing that it's a demon. Uh-huh. And I think there's certain things you'll see throughout the film that sort of give you that nod, almost try and make you, especially toward the end when you almost know it's demons, try and make you go back a little bit and think, well, maybe this is still in her head. The big thing for me is that our evidence is circumstantial, if that makes any sense. We talked about how Rosemary is our primary character and we follow everything she does. But I mean, let's try and start from the beginning. What is our evidence of Satanism? When do you start to get the feeling that this is, if you don't already know by the time you've started watching the film, Baby Damien?
Well, really, the first sign of any oddity that you get comes from the... Well, the first... There's weird signs that I don't even really pay attention to until later in the film when you kind of realize them in retrospect. Just things like the pictures on the wall, things like the singing through
the chanting,
joined wall, that kind of thing. But the real... The first sign of danger that you get is what you may construe as her first pregnant delusion.
Yes, right.
Even though she may or may not be pregnant yet, it's subjective as to even when she gets pregnant, because she could have gotten pregnant on the make love on the floor scene.
Yeah, she could have.
In which case, this scene where she's in bed and she has sex with the demon or guy.
But it doesn't matter who it is. Sleep it's raped. Not Anton LaVey.
She gets sleep raped is what happens, whether it be by the devil himself or her frisky husband.
Can we just stop for a second there? Is that okay? Am I the only one bothered by this?
You're not the only one bothered by it.
Even if it's not demons, I'm not okay with sleep rape. Okay, but all of this stuff you're mentioning, even the Tannis stuff, pictures, all of that is, and when I say circumstantial, here's what I mean. These are all things that Rosemary has seen, she has discovered, or someone has told her directly about. It's as if the audience is Rosemary. We never see a scene where it's Guy talking to the doctor and Rosemary's not around. Even when we get little bits of establishing shots, none of that ever comes together in what I will call the demon conspiracy. The pictures on the wall, something she notices, she mentions. The chanting, something she hears in bed. Now, other people hear it. I'm not saying these things aren't happening. That's not the case, which is kind of what I did with The Prestige. Yeah. I just plugged my ears and said, ignore these three scenes. These are certainly things that are happening. But we get some excuses. I mean, you and me right away go, okay, maybe it's the TV in the other room. Guy gives the excuse of playing a recorder in the other room. But I'm not saying there was never a sound coming from that apartment. In fact, I'm not even saying it isn't devil worshippers. The only thing I'm contesting is that she gives birth to a demon child. It's possible that there is still a coven of witches, or an oven of witches, as Four Rooms would tell you, in the other room, and maybe they even want her baby. I'll even go that far. That doesn't mean those aren't there. But to
so
make the
only contest that you have is that Rosemary pops out a little baby devil.
Yeah, I mean, I think different things throughout the film rest on different levels of uncertainty. But at the very least, I think you can go up through the film to that point and say she really did have a miscarriage.
And I'm willing to just swallow the blue pill and go, okay, fine.
You know, you mentioned the original dream sequence. There's a couple of dream sequences. Mm-hmm. throughout the movie, and they just slide into the dream sequences with less and less of a separation each time they do it, until you get to the end, where I think you're meant to wonder if the last sequence is in her head or not. The guy tells her that, actually I think the doctor tells her, because he just can't do it, that she had a miscarriage. She did not have the baby. And from there, that's enough to set her off into a fever dream. But you see her stop taking her pills. Not only do you watch her several times not take her pills, but they go so far as to bring the camera over to where she's hiding them and show how they've accumulated, so you don't accidentally think maybe she didn't take two of her pills. She hasn't been taking any of her pills. Now, someone who wants to believe in demons could say something crazy like the pills are supposed to poison her or whatever the pills are supposed to do. But what would make the most sense to me is that this woman needs some sort of sedation. She needs some kind of antipsychotic at this point, because she was already running around and they threatened to throw her in a psych ward because she thinks everybody is a demon. She is paranoid. She's delusional. And now she had a miscarriage. She's going to have a breakdown. I don't think it's too far to say that her husband said, put her on some antipsychotics, or at the very least sedate her so she can get some sleep, so she can recover from this accident that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So here's where all of the evidence really comes together. She goes through the passage, she goes to the other room, and I think the items in the room are very telling. I could watch this scene over and over because there's so much different stuff that they have thrown in that room for you to pick apart. All of the things that show up that appear to be evidence to someone watching through the demon lens.
Mm-hmm.
The pictures are up on the wall. Here are all the people who are chanting. These are all things that we talked about before that Rosemary sees. We don't find anything outside of the scope of what Rosemary knows. So if you were to conjecture that she is having a dream, she could be piecing together, in much the way a conspiracy theorist does, the different items that all lend credibility to this idea of a coven of witches. She sees the pictures up on the wall. Doesn't really make sense to put a bunch of pictures on your wall of Satan stuff, but it doesn't really make sense to believe in Satan either. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to pull that apart. But these aren't things that we saw, you know, we didn't see the camera linger in the other room earlier in the film and show no pictures. We heard her say it. She knows in her mind that there's no pictures. It wouldn't make sense that in her dream, shows up, no pictures. People show up chanting. I'll give you a good example of the opposite. This would completely negate the natural explanation of the film. There's the Asian guy, the photographer.
Mm-hmm.
If we had witnessed earlier in the film, guy talking to an Asian photographer and Rosemary never knowing about that, and then that Asian photographer shows up, probably not a dream, or it would have to be a huge coincidence. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it
have to
sense.
Be a big coincidence.
I understand everything
you're saying.
Because how
would she know about that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm not saying it's evidence. It just makes this a very compatible theory.
So the thing that I don't know if you're taking into account when you're coming up with, I guess it's not you. When people take into account when they come up with the, you know, the reality theory, let's call it.
Sure, I like
let's
that.
Let's call it the reality theory.
Reality-based theories on the show.
But the thing that I don't think is being taken into account is how much that detracts from the end of the film. Essentially, it's the same as any other film where, pick a film where a character falls asleep and then just imagine that from that point on, the rest of the film is a dream. Nothing that happens after that scene is important to the storyline.
You're worried that this is Tommy Westfall, or that this is the end of Dallas, you know, that we're waking up, everything is a dream. Sorry, I just spoiled the series of Dallas, so you should probably try and return that DVD box set while you can. But yeah, that it takes away from the story, the terror throughout.
Because this is supposedly the climax of the film.
Sure.
And if the climax of the film takes place in a psychosis, I don't care.
I could see that point of view, and I think that's part of the genius of making compatible theories. Something, when we talked to Jeremy Kasdan, he said he tried to do it with the Attic Expeditions.
Mm-hmm.
Several different ways that the film can operate. And it's a clever thing to do because it gives you a wider appeal, you know, almost from a production standpoint. If you want people to like your film and you want a lot of people to see the film over and over. So I'm completely fine with setting this in a fictional universe where she had a demon baby. And that's a fine thing for you to look at the film and go, that's what happened. I just think it's interesting to note that it could have this other explanation, and they are completely compatible. We can't go into the film and Joe Nickel further research out of that situation. All we have is the facts that are given to us. What I find really, really interesting is that the first time I went through this, and this seems to be pretty universal, I went with a couple people who knew nothing about Rosemary's Baby. Did not know it was a film from the 60s, did not know it was a popular film. Don't ask me how I never heard of Rosemary's Baby before I went to see it. That's crazy. only really knew that it was directed by Roman Polanski and part of an apartment trilogy, but went with a couple people who, like myself, are skeptical-minded individuals and didn't know anything about demons. Went through most of the film, even the first dream sequence, before everybody kind of got the notion that, all right, maybe it's demons. And we all walked out at the end, and I think probably because of that pill scene, thinking, all right, well, that could have been her breakdown into psychosis, into complete delusion, showing that, you know, there's no hope for this character. And that's kind of the story arc I like. Mm-hmm. You said you feel the need to have an actual demon baby as part of the climax, otherwise you feel cheated.
Well, because I feel like the most important part of the film is what happens at the very end, where she gives in to this shit that she's been tortured by for 9 months.
Sure.
And decides that even though I've been fighting it and it's been killing me,
that babies are more important than demons.
Well, it's just, it's not even the decision of her being a mother. It's just the fact that this character who has been fighting the entirety of the film just gives up.
Sure. And that is a really, really important beat in her character. It's the final beat. Yeah. It's the last piece of her character arc. And I don't think looking at it naturally necessarily, I mean, you have to really buy into some dream theory there. You have to go, all right, that is her consciousness telling her that she's giving in.
But I don't buy into dream anything.
No, I know. And neither do I. I'm really making a stretch here. At the most, I will give you that you completely lose that development in the character. And I understand that that's important. But just in talking to these people, and to get back to the point I was making, talking to these people who all came out of the movie the first time going, okay, natural explanation, you have to think that the movie is about a character that went psychotic, not a character who eventually gave in. Those are two different stories you and I are talking about, two different character arcs. What's interesting is the second time through, knowing that this is a movie about Satanism, about demons, however you want to phrase that, it appears that there is evidence everywhere. You know, I talked about it being like a conspiracy theory. Once you buy into a conspiracy theory, when we talked about loose change, perfect example, everything is evidence for the conspiracy. When you look at it objectively, none of it really makes any sense, but it seems like, isn't this odd that this happens? Isn't it strange that this thing over here does this? And when you watch Rosemary's Baby, if you've watched it before with a sort of naturalistic perspective, reality theory. If you watched it before like that, and now you know how it ends, you seem to find even more evidence for that ending than the characters themselves do. It's as if every scene is shouting at you, here's stuff for the you mentioned, you know, different moments when Guy leaves the apartment, right. What he could be doing, talking to the neighbors, and the birthday, planning.
The birthday is June of 66, which is doubly strange considering the film was made in 68 and 2 years don't really make a chronological difference in this film.
So there's different hints of that. You know, we even talked about as we were watching the film, the original scene where Guy, you know, at what point does Guy turn would be a question you would ask yourself. The original scene where they go over to their neighbor's apartment for the first time, Guy is having a separate conversation we can't hear. Maybe that's where he's making his deal with the devil, where he's saying, I really want to be a great actor. Mm-hmm. His neighbor knows about his acting career, which seems a little coincidental, even though he's all over TV. So maybe it's not that big of a coincidence. But I think it's really interesting how once you start with that conclusion, how you can suddenly find evidence all over the place. Fun fact, before Invasion, Michael Bay was slated to do a remake of Rosemary's Baby. I will let part of you inside die right now. But I think that plan has been dissolved. Although maybe by the time the podcast goes up this week, there will suddenly be a Rosemary's Baby remake out there. There was a remake of a 50s classic, Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
This isn't the only remake, is it?
No, there's about 10 of them.
10 remakes.
All right, so there's actually four. There's the original 50s, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. There's the 1978 Philip Kaufman directed version, which we will be talking about
today. That's the one we're doing today.
Yes, that's the one. That's the one we saw. There is Body Snatchers, which is the
Ferrara
film. And then there is The Invasion, which is the Nicole Kidman film that came out recently. All of them, I think, do some interesting stuff. I'm not going to knock any of the remakes, although some are clearly better than others. And maybe the 50s version is the most interesting. Maybe it's the most original and maybe the most well done, which
pretty
is
sure
sad.
It's the most original.
Not necessarily. You haven't seen the two new ones. I would wait until you say that. There's some crazy shit in those films. So before we even get into this, can I just complain about something really quick?
I love when you complain about things because it makes it seem like I don't complain that much.
Plants don't have feelings. Do any of our listeners think plants have feelings? Was the pause for listeners shouting, I think that?
Yeah.
So this belief is actually far more prevalent than you would really hope. It's sort of the same with horoscopes. You know, you'll be talking to a group of your friends and then you'll mention it, or even 9/11 conspiracies like we just talked talking about loose change, where South Park makes the joke 1 out of 4. You know, you'll be talking to a group of people and you'll think that they're all pretty smart people, but then one will pipe up that they think 9/11 is a conspiracy. I get that sometimes with plants have feelings. It's all the Clive Baxter stuff, the polygraphs in the 60s. And as we often do, I'm just going to refer everybody to Mythbusters because they did an episode about that with some really strange results, actually. But there is a scene where they talk about plants having feelings, and plants don't have feelings. But that's okay, because there are mud baths. You like the mud bath scene. You're a big fan of mud baths. The mud bath
scene was really...
Have you ever had a mud bath?
I have not had a mud bath.
All right.
So we've been dealing with a few weird moments when we're watching these films recently, where something happens that I've never experienced, and I just turn to you and go, I want a mud bath.
Yeah, right.
Or I want acupuncture.
Sure. That was a recent one.
It's just, I see these things happening in film, and it's always horrible.
Yeah.
It's always horrible. The acupuncture scene takes place in Wizard of Gore,
right,
where there's poison in his body.
Yeah.
But all I'm thinking is, oh, yeah, leeches and needles. That sounds like a good time. Yeah. Or in this film, Jeff Goldblum is about to get turned into a pod man.
Yep.
And I go, I could really go for a mud bath.
Here's, I'm going to give you my skeptical angle on this one.
On mud baths?
Yeah, on mud baths and acupuncture. Well, and this is why I let the plant thing go, because Nancy also, and we'll talk about some of the feminism stuff that's really cool here, but Nancy owns this mud bath place, and it's not a medicinal mud bath.
Right.
They don't tell anyone they're going to cure cancer with mud baths as chiropractors and acupuncture specialists do, but there's something to being touched by another human being. It's that simple. You like a massage, right?
Sure.
It might take away a headache, for instance. It might relieve your stress, but you don't think it's going to, you know, cure a broken limb. People just like being touched by, it's almost the placebo effect. I think there's something even a little bit more, but people just like human contact. They like being touched by other people, and sometimes they like to be covered in mud. Feels a little weird. It's like
shaving your whole body and then rolling around in silk sheets.
I think we've lingered on this topic too long. So I mentioned the feminism, and that's something that's new to the 70s version. A lot of people like the 70s version more than the 50s. And while I don't think blow for blow it's as good of a film, I think there's still a lot of really cool new things that they brought to it. Above all, you can tell that it's very much of its era. The 70s being another great wave of the feminist movement. All of the women have jobs. They all do something important. You know, Elizabeth works for the Department of Health. Nancy owns the mud bath place. In fact, it's Nancy. Nancy's a great character, as much as she's not really one of the main characters. I love her in this film. Don't get confused. This isn't the same Nancy that wakes up the people sleeping who are going to die.
In Nightmare on Elm Street 1, 3, and New Nightmare.
Isn't that weird that it's also a Nancy and it's sort of the same wake up
Don't fall asleep.
Yeah, it's Don't Fall Asleep. Nightmare fans would like, if you haven't seen the Invasion of the Body Snatchers movies and you're a fan of the Nightmare on Elm Street series, I would say those are, you could almost insert this somewhere into.
Maybe.
It's one Robert Englund short of being
that,
a Nightmare
but that,
on Elm
I mean,
Street.
That's,
that no longer means anything.
That's Nightmare on Elm Street, though. At least it was.
Don't get sad. Think about women bathing in mud.
Ah.
So it's not just the job stuff. Nancy figures out that you can fool the pod people. She's the one who comes to them after disappearing.
She shows up like 3 times.
Yeah, she does. She just appears out of nowhere with new information. She's been living among the pod people, and she knows that, you know, you can walk among them if you just sort of pretend to be a pod person. They won't know. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, maybe their collective consciousness has grown so large that they no longer can tell who's in and who's out. But I think it's interesting that their situation looks fucking hopeless until she comes to them and says, you know what, there might be a way around this. In fact, Nancy's the only one who even lives.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see her die within the film. But as far as we're concerned, she's the only one who makes it to the very end of the film. So I think there are a lot of really great, strong roles for women. And I think that's no accident that that happened in the late 70s. You know what else happened in the late 70s? Leonard Nimoy?
Leonard Nimoy happened... That's not true, though.
Well, it happened in the late 70s as well as the 60s.
Leonard Nimoy happened in the 60s, and then he was not Spock for a while.
I'm sorry, Spock happened in the 60s. Leonard Nimoy happened in the 70s. I think I have that correct, do I not?
Yeah, you're right. He put out that I Am Not Spock novel,
yeah, right,
which flopped just as much as his attempted career during that time. And then he showed up as sci-fi poster boy for the remainder of the Star Trek TOS films. And
there is such a good J.J. Abrams joke in here that I don't want to make because it's a spoiler, but I was just about to drop it in. But yes, we've seen some Leonard Nimoy recently, and it's quite fantastic. So there's all this pop psychology stuff in here. Mm-hmm. What do you make of this?
I don't really think it has anything to do with what's going on.
You know, that's interesting. I was going to say the exact same thing. Yeah, I was curious just to get a different perspective on that, but it seems like a total it's a red herring.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? All this pop psychology stuff comes up, and it's really almost satirical, talking about the relationships people share.
There's odd rivalry. There's odd pop psychologist rivalry in mm-hmm. this film that it seems so out of place. It seems maybe a note to convey, look at your petty lives, pay attention to the big picture.
Well, I got that feeling too. We'll talk about that a bit in the ending, but the advantage that the pod people have, they don't have superpowers, at least not in this film. They can't run extra fast. They can't leap over tall buildings or do all those other terrible Superman devices. All they have is a collective consciousness. It's almost, if you want to read into it, this kind of idea that if we all work together, we could solve problems. And part of the reason humanity was squashed is because we don't have very good communication skills, which does kind of get back to what Leonard Nimoy is saying a little bit.
Yeah, but I also think that a lot of the reason that people were squashed is because we didn't know we were going to be invaded.
Well, that's why I say almost.
That's
it's
unfair.
total complete
that's a low blow.
Bullshit to come to this film and say, you know, had the humans really worked together? Fuck you. They worked together.
That was a low blow. Space. Fuck you, space.
I think there is a bigger theme in here, though, than please work together.
Do the pod people have nipples?
Do the pod people have nipples is an important question to our discussion.
Not the theme.
But not the theme.
I wasn't paying attention.
No, the theme, Mr. Kester, is paranoia. I think this started with Nixon, but that was so early. I mean, this late in the decade, it's taken on a mind of its own. It was just part of the culture of the 70s. Maybe it was all the pot. People were really fucking paranoid. And the pod people, I mean, how more paranoid could you get? It's when we talked about the John Carpenter movie.
The Thing?
Yes, The Thing. Where you don't know who it is. You don't know who you can trust. It's the reason all of these conspiracy FBI kind of movies exist today. It's that same theme of paranoia. Who can be trusted? Who can't? And here you have a science fiction premise that lends itself to that beautifully. They're pod people. They're indistinguishable from other people.
Yeah.
They don't move much differently. And the end of the film hits on this quite a bit where they're not robots. This isn't the Terminator franchise. They're not without emotion, although they're sort of without emotion. But they still have facial expressions. They still look, act, communicate.
Well, the thing that disconnects me from the don't show emotion thing
uh-huh.
is that they're manipulative.
Yeah, they are. They are.
By being, and I don't mean manipulative in the sense that they use machinery.
Sure.
I mean, they lie. Or maybe they are right. not lying. I guess that's a question to probe, right?
Sure.
When they say something like, it's great, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me, I'm
right.
having such a good time.
I think they're probably telling the truth. What they've told us is that they don't have fear or love. What we're seeing more is a step in evolution. I mean, that's what they call it. They haven't eradicated all feeling. They still have expressions, which have a little bit to do with feeling. They have motivation, more importantly. You see motivation of the pod people all throughout the film. They have some kind of drive to do what they're doing, even if they're all trying to do one thing. You know, they have a mission. It's a very animalistic.
Mm-hmm.
A dog knows it has to eat at the end of the day. It can't solve a complicated puzzle, and you're not really going to see it express
facial expressions of Jerry Garcia.
Oh, Banjo Dog. You had to bring a Banjo Dog, didn't you?
The film brought up Banjo Dog.
We'll chase Banjo Dog down in a minute. Let me finish my point. All I'm saying is dogs don't have long-term planning. They
right.
don't really know that they're going to die. They don't have that kind of fear. I think it's a similar step in evolution. I'm not trying to make the point that animals don't have fear or show fear. But this is a step in the evolution where pod people know they're going to die. They're aware of potential demise, but they've eradicated fear. So it's humanity still, but slightly different, slightly more alien.
I disagree. I don't think, I mean, and I don't know for sure,
mm-hmm.
but I don't feel like evolution... I don't think evolution can be run on a universal scale where different species combine. I'm pretty sure that's not how evolution works.
I'm pretty sure evolution is when evolution, the spacemen turned monkeys into men using lasers. Is that not how evolution worked? No? No lasers? Maybe I need to read a textbook.
It wasn't lasers. It was like a high-power light beam.
No, you're right. This isn't really evolution. Coming over and killing off the human race and replacing them with things that spit out of pods is an evolution. They're using evolution as a kind of a clumsy metaphor. People know what evolution is. They remember the chart.
Some people don't
know
what evolution is.
It's true. This is America. In Chicago, most people know what evolution is. After all, this is Uptown where you can see human evolution on the streets, really. But everyone understands what I'm saying. Let's get to Banjo Dog, because that's really the important part of this film. I'm amazed at the 78 version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers' ability to go from kind of funny, kind of cheesy 70s humor to incredibly serious, and then have a Banjo Dog in the mix. So you got the feeling when we were watching this that this was kind of a funny film, right?
Yeah. Well, there's the telling scene for me was the rat turd caper scene.
Rat shit, yeah.
That was borderline slapstick.
It really was.
And
it's lowbrow. It's incredibly lowbrow. Yes. But don't you see that shit in the soup is really a larger metaphor
for a Banjo Dog in your film? Yeah, it's pretty much the same thing.
But the film gets serious really quickly again, and I blame it all on sound. We talked about sound a lot last episode with Blair Witch Project.
Mm-hmm.
This movie uses sound in a different way, but it's a lot more synthetic. I think that lends itself to the pods. You know, this idea that synthetic aliens are going to take over everything. Part of it is that it's also in the 70s when it's in 1978, the year of the synthesizer, as I will needlessly dub it right now. And so you get that wump, wump, wump sound, the one that goes in and out of sync. And it doesn't sound like you're having a funny, happy Adam Sandler time. It sounds like you're done eating rat shit and now it's time to kill some pod people. The other sound you get is from the actual creatures.
Yeah.
From the
pod folks.
Yes, from the pod folks. Reminds me of another film we saw earlier this year.
The Brother from Another Planet nightmare.
Yeah, there was. Not the film.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying the film was a nightmare.
No, the nightmarish scene that still terrifies me even to this day. A similar kind of sound there. It, fucking terrifying. And you have to give them credit for having a little bit of reserve in using the sound of the creature screaming, because it's not going to be as frightening if it's that terrifying the first time. You want it to be the most terrifying in the last time you see it, which is hard to pull off. So it has to be muffled a little bit. It has to be in crowds.
And your lead actor has to have a really odd face.
Donald Sutherland. So after the meat cart, we got a meat cart in here too.
Oh, yeah.
What was that? Hostel 1. Okay. So there's a scene in one of the Hostel films. Go back and look it up on our show. All right. Hostel 1, I'll take your word. That we have deemed the meat cart, and I thought we would get to use that phrase all the time, but I'm pretty sure this is basically the first time we've used it.
We use it every once in a while. It's the thing with that and stuff like Hamster Style is they happen in every film.
Yeah.
And we can't call them out every time.
Yeah, but the camera work really reminded me of the original meat cart.
Yeah.
So, all right, the scene is they're getting out of the taxi, and the cop is coming over to the taxi, and we as an audience are led to believe they're going to be caught. But there is a time gap where when the camera cuts back to what should be them being terrified in the backseat, mm-hmm. the door has already swung open before we even knew it, and they were on their way out. So from there, from the meat cart scene, they destroy the greenhouse, humanity wins, everything's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Or you at least get the scene that you think is kind of the climax where we're destroying the greenhouse. Takes an interesting turn from there. The last scene could go a couple of ways. Our protagonist here, Donald Sutherland's character, could be a pod person, or he could be a normal person pretending to be a pod person. If I was reading your reaction correctly as we watched the film, you had no doubt that he was a pod person.
Mm-hmm.
So you knew that whole time. By the time you get to the ending, because, and here's maybe the tell in that situation, I'm going to give you a poker tip for future reference. When Nancy shouts out his name, you said, "Oh no," really loudly. So, or "Don't do that," or something to that effect, which I believe is the moment that I knew, okay, Michael saw the pod person thing coming. I had so much hope that his character, because we don't see him captured.
Right.
We see them saying, you know, you can't not sleep forever. What did they say?
You can't stay awake for your whole life or something.
Yeah, you have to sleep sometime.
You're going to get tired, is what they say.
So then we make the jump and you don't know. I'm following through that whole scene in another really well-crafted execution of events, much like, you know, the scene earlier where you see the shadows on the wall, maybe the origins of that scene where you see the giant shadow spotlight, you know, running against the wall. Something I remember from Left 4 Dead, the original. You see the scenes when they first try and walk among the pod people outside where it's just their feet. Another well-executed scene at the end where he's just sort of blending in. You're trying to read his face because you still don't know how robotic they have to act. And then he gets to the end, and Nancy turns out to be the sole survivor. And you get that terrifying fucking
point,
that
and, point screech.
And screech is awful. It makes me feel terrible and gives me this lingering feeling that I can't actually go out onto Montrose for the rest of the day because people out here will actually do that too. Well, whether you believe he's a pod person or not, I think there's still some uncertainty in that scene. And you don't expect him to just whip around and make that face at the end. So it's still scary no matter what.
Oh, yeah, totally.
But I want to know if you think this ending's really a downer. Assuming that, you know, they make her part of the collective, right? That Nancy doesn't actually get away, which she could very well just run into the ocean and swim to Europe or Australia or wherever she really feels like swimming. Will assimilation save humanity?
No.
No? No. You don't believe in
turns
the
out
people?
When you get assimilated, it's no longer humanity. It's podmanity.
Sounds like the listenership of our show, Podmanity.
Done.
I won't tell you which film, but one of the films really hits on this idea that humans have war and humans have problems, and under Podmanity, none of these people will have any problems. So you're telling me that you, Michael Kester, Mr. Contrarian, do not believe in assimilating for the good of the whole?
No, well, it's not for the good of the whole, it's for the good of the pods.
All right, I completely agree with you. I don't know how anyone could take that point of view. Unless they were fucking cynical and evil. So fuck you people. Speaking of fucking, we have ourselves a place on the internet.
Yeah,
a
we
website.
Do.
It is doublefeatureshow.com. We also have a Gmail address, which you hear about week to week. Send us more emails.
I want all of our listenership to just send us an email, and all I want you to do is don't even put a subject. No subject, and just in all caps, I am part of Podmanity.
Getting our listeners to all do the same thing is like herding fucking cats. So good luck with that. But we'll see how many people
Doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. I am part of Podmanity.
You know what? And you could also leave that as part of an iTunes review. I think we're onto something here. This is a good tagline for our show. We'll make sure to put it on the DVD jacket when we make the biopic.
Yeah.
Next up, we have the greatest double feature of all time. Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill, What do you mean, no?
No, that's way later.
Faster Pussycat and Mean Girls would be an excellent double feature. Why are we not doing that? You better have a great reason for me.
We're doing JCVD and Bronson instead.
I've never even heard of those films.
It's for the good of Podmanity.
Why the fuck are we doing JCVD and Bronson? What's that about?
It's, I don't know.
Lindsay Lohan is not in either of those films.
I honestly haven't seen
either
one.
Wait, Bronson's the thing about Ilsa, She-Wolf, something?
I haven't seen it yet.
So what actually happened is Podmanity was not thinking as part of a collective. They were trying to be individuals. We get these things, I believe listeners call them requests, every week. And while we really appreciate everyone's email, we just laugh at and mock your requests behind your back.
We're not going to do Blade Runner.
Look, there is an art, no matter how small, petty, trivial the art form is, to putting together the double feature. And we like to at least have seen the movies. At least one of us has, in almost every case, seen the movie a billion times. With year two, we've both seen most of the movies a billion times. These are two movies that a listener wanted us to do, and I'm not going to start naming names because then all the listeners will think they can write us in, we're going to do their double feature, and then we're going to give them a big shout out on the show. That's not going to happen. So we're just going to try this little experiment. We're just blindly going to watch a double feature. We're going to do this one time and see how it works out. And I could have been watching Mean Girls. I'm kind of upset about this.
We'll get to it.
I'm upset.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.